This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, the Prime Minister will be joining me to discuss immigration, the coming election, and whether the threat of the far right has been underplayed in Australia. And with the federal poll looming, I go to the hard-fought seat of Indi, where the big issues are not refugees, but lousy trains, the need for rehab beds, and notorious mobile black spots.
And the message says mobile network unavailable.
Yeah, so that's what you cop all the time. We need better phone service because I'm scared someone's going to get burnt.
Until the service is improved, she's resorting to zigzagging around her backyard to search for a signal to phone family and return missed calls. New Zealand's minister responsible for the country's domestic security agency has admitted that a plan to tackle far-right extremism had not been completed at the time of the Christchurch terrorist attack. In an interview with the NZ Herald, Andrew Little has admitted that the Security Intelligence Service only started explicitly working on what he describes as alt-right stuff in mid last year. The news will come as no surprise to New Zealand's Muslim communities who feel like the threat of white nationalist groups hasn't been properly dealt with. Steve Kinnane reports from Wellington.
Really strong, mate. Really strong.
Over a coffee in a share house in Wellington, Ibrahim Omar is letting out some of his frustrations over the failure of New Zealand security services to prevent last week's terrorist attack.
I think there is no question that if those comments that were made online by this man and what were written online by this man, if that was made by a Muslim, any Muslim, I think it would be taken seriously, and I think he would have been in trouble.
Ibrahim is originally from Eritrea and now helps refugees resettle in New Zealand. He says Muslims have been over-monitored by security services, while white nationalists have largely been ignored. He says Muslim communities have told police they've been targeted by skinheads and white supremacists, both online and in the street.
A lot of people basically been telling me that they've been chased by some hateful and racist skinhead gangs, and women have been told to go back where they came from. You don't belong here, you don't look like us, you're not one of us. Some extent, sometimes the hijabs have been pulled off from their heads, and all sorts of abuse. We knew there was a problem, but we didn't think that was going to come this soon and this big.
Peter Dunn was in the New Zealand Parliament for 33 years, and around half of that time was spent as a minister. In recent years, he successfully pushed to have regular five-year reviews of the country's intelligence agencies. He says the security services have never been better resourced or trained, but he hopes a new inquiry announced by the Prime Minister will get to the bottom of whether New Zealand's agencies have been negligent when it comes to far-right extremists.
I think there is some substance to that criticism. How far it goes, the inquiries will reveal. But the general flavour, if you like, of publicly reported intelligence work over the last few years has been against jihadists, people fighting with ISIS, and so on and so forth. There's been very little public attention given to right-wing extremist groups. I'm not saying that means they weren't being surveilled, but there hasn't been any public reporting of that having happened.
The admission from the Minister, Andrew Little, that security agencies were still planning how to deal with the far-right threat is embarrassing for the government, and it won't be well received in Muslim communities in New Zealand who had already felt that little was being done. In Wellington, this is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
The federal government is unveiling a population policy today. It will cap the nation's permanent migration intake at 160,000 people for the next 4 years. That's about the level it's at now. It's a reduction of 30,000 places. It's also introducing a new skilled worker visa covering 23,000 migrants, but it will require them to live in regional areas of the nation for a minimum of 3 years as a condition for them securing permanent residency. It's also promising better, faster rail links to some regional cities to help relieve congestion. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, joined me a short time ago, but we began with questions about the New Zealand investigation. Prime Minister, thanks for joining AM.
Thank you, Sabra.
How would you quantify the threat of right-wing extremists in Australia?
I think it's serious, and I think it always has been, and that's why at the federal level our agencies have always taken it seriously. And the work that they've done over a long period of time, I think, has greatly assisted us, particularly in recent days when we've been responding to the issue, the terrible tragedy in Christchurch, the terrorist attack, to ensure that we're well prepared for the response that was needed here.
The New Zealand minister over there, Andrew Little, says that authorities there were only really alert to this midway through last year. What assurances can you give Australians here that their investigations are on point?
The Australian investigations picked up immediately, and we've been assisting not only directly with the inquiries in New Zealand, but also providing assistance and coordinating that investigation, linking up with other countries around the world. When it comes to our knowledge of white supremacists or separatists or other extreme groups like this, we have got quite a bit of intelligence in these areas, and it goes back quite a way on these groups. So we'll continue to act on that, and that is very much informing our participation.
Where would you suggest voters in the upcoming federal election put One Nation and the Shooters Party?
Well, we're not having any preference deals with One Nation, not having any preference deals with the Greens or Labor, for that matter. When the nominations are all set, that's when our preferences are determined.
Yeah, will you instruct your organisation to put them somewhere?
Well, we'll wait for who is on the list of every candidate all around the country. I mean, as we've seen in the past, there can be some individuals who present to have very, very extreme views, even beyond those of some of those you've mentioned. So, I mean, we'll wait to see what all the nominations are, and that's our normal process. I mean, was it the last election that Labor did a preference deal with One Nation? I recall it. Their member for Dapel was elected on the basis of it.
Is Essentia strong enough for Fraser Anning in Parliament? Some want him suspended for the rest of the term.
Well, look, the suspension is a matter that the senators will consider. I understand that's being discussed, but in terms of a motion that is currently being moved by the government with support of the opposition, I think is highly appropriate. And I think he should face the full force of the law personally, and that is what I expect state and territory police authorities to be looking at.
In regards to assault or in regards to hate speech?
Well, I think there are a range of avenues open there, and I'd expect people to be applying the law.
On to your announcement today. This intention has been flagged for a long time. The rate that you want is one that Australia's currently close to. Is this confirmation of something already happening?
What today is about a comprehensive plan for Australia's future population growth. I want to see Australians getting home safer and earlier to spend time with their families. I want to see tradies being able to get on site, not sit in traffic jams. And that means you need a balanced, responsible migration settings, but it also means taking opportunities outside the big cities, whether that's in Adelaide or Darwin or in regional locations like Newcastle or places like that. It's about seizing the opportunities where they present and relieving the congestion burden where it's really impacting on quality of living. And so that's what the plan is designed to do. And that means busting congestion with the infrastructure investments we're making, planning for future population growth together with the states and territories who take on a much bigger role, moving from determining less than a fifth of the total intake to more than a quarter. And then, of course, continuing to bring Australians together and working on the social cohesion, the social fabric, which provides the very opportunity for continued prosperity and Australians living well together.
The Chamber of Commerce and Industries, James Pearson, has described this shift as an economic own goal, and he says it's very disappointing that you're imposing a lower cap. How do you respond?
I think once James has the opportunity to actually read the policy, I think you'll react in a more measured way.
I've spoken to him personally this morning.
Well, look, he's entitled to his view, but I think what Australians need and our economy needs is a balanced and responsible migration plan. I mean, under this plan, we're seeing increased places for employer-nominated skilled visas. Under this plan, we're seeing opportunities for more regional visas where there are some over more than 40,000 job vacancies in regional Australia. So this is about ensuring that our migration plan is tied towards where the opportunities are and relieving the congestion which can slow economic growth. I mean, a tradie isn't getting paid when they're sitting in a traffic jam. They get paid when they get on site.
Sure.
And his members, who are tradies, will want to get on site and have a good migration plan that helps them do that and infrastructure to back it up.
This announcement comes 3 days out from a crucial state election where population growth and congestion are very big issues there and where the incumbent Liberal Party is in trouble. What's the public to make of this timing?
That this is a important plan that we've been working on from the day that I became Prime Minister. I took these matters to COEC last December. This has been the product of an enormous amount of work, and I said that it needed to be finalised before we handed down the budget, because the migration settings, as handed down in the budget, Sabra, which, as you know, is in less than a fortnight. I think the issues that relate to this matter in the New South Wales election that are germane are the outrageous comments by Mr Daly. I mean, Mr Daly has basically said that Asians take Australian jobs. And I just find that abhorrent. With all the talk about these issues lately, I mean, I denounce those comments, and I think Bill Shorten should do the same.
What is the economic... where is the economic modelling, and what are the economic benefits of your announcement, given that migration is a very strong economic stimulus?
Well, the fiscal impacts of this plan are no impact. It has no impact on the budget, and that's what we've been working through, and that's why it is, I think, a very responsible level of intake. There are others who would have liked to have seen lower levels of intake. I don't share those views. This level of intake, I think, is the one that continues to support the important employer-nominated skills stream. 70% of our intake under this plan is skilled. And they are that's the program which helps drive the economy forward. So this is a positive plan for the economy. Now, there is nothing to suggest that this would do anything other than support our current growth levels in the economy while avoiding the serious congestion problems which can slow our economy down.
23,000 migrants will be required to live in regional areas under this plan. How will you force them to do that? And will there be jobs for them?
No, look, that is a misrepresentation of the plan. What it is the opportunity for 23 places for skilled migrants to settle and remain in regional Australia. No one's being forced anywhere. This is an opportunity for people, and we're talking about places outside the big cities. So that includes Adelaide. It includes Darwin.
Sure, but you can't compel them to live in those places.
Well, what the visas will do will say that if you have complied with the terms of the visa to live in a regional area, then you will be able to apply for permanent residency. Now, this is what is very important at the end of the day. If you comply with the arrangements, particularly for the issues around where student visas, where there'll be extra incentives for students to go and study in regional areas, which will be very good for regional economies, then the ticket to permanent residency will mean being able to have maintained your provisional requirements of your visa to live in those areas. Now, that is a very big incentive. When people come to Australia on those visas, and there is a requirement for them to be in particular places, and it can be all over the country. It's not in one particular area. And if there are no jobs in those places, they won't go there. They will go where there are jobs and where places and cities are looking for them to come. I mean, Adelaide, Arana, Kalgoorlie, Darwin, Warrnambool, all of these places have been telling us that they actually want to see more people, and there'll be opportunities for them to go there. And where they take up those visas, whether they're state-sponsored or whether they're under the new visa forms we're announcing today, then that will provide them with a better pathway towards permanent residence. So it's done through incentive. That's where it's done.
All right, Prime Minister, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
A federal election will be called within weeks. This morning, we're broadcasting from the town of Wodonga in Victoria on the New South Wales border. Wodonga's part of the federal seat of Indi, currently held by the independent MP Cathy McGowan, who is retiring. The crucial seat is now up for grabs, with the Liberal, Labor, National and National parties contesting it, as well as another independent candidate. But rather than talk with them about what's important here, I've spoken with locals. And they nominate fast rail, mobile phone black spots and the lack of rehab beds as key issues.
My name's Cheryl Jones. I live in Boho South, near Vault Town in North East Victoria. I love it. Just wish it was my own instead of rented.
Boho South is nestled near the Strathbogie Ranges. It's a sleepy, farmy settlement, a kind of blink-and-you-could-miss-it place. That's the attraction, but it's also a notorious mobile phone black spot. You've got your mobile in your hand, but how often does it actually work?
Once in a blue moon. We've got very bad phone reception here. Some people can't even pick up 000s.
How many people are in the same boat?
Nearly everyone from Mirapol right up to Mangalore. Even Benalla is complaining now, so probably distance of over 100 k's or more.
Mobile phone black spots are reported in many parts of this electorate. The government this week announced money to build four new towers in dropout zones. Boho wasn't on the list.
We need better phone service. We are in a bushfire area. Please do something because I'm scared someone's going to get burnt and it's not going to come up. See?
And the message says mobile network unavailable.
Yeah. So that's what you cop all the time.
Further north, about half an hour out of Wodonga, is a nondescript home with a stunning view of the nearby mountains.
So my name's Michelle Matush and I work at Eagles Corner.
It's a not-for-profit organisation. It set up a home 18 months ago for men to detox from drugs and alcohol and teach them new skills to find work. Some are homeless. Some are also dealing with anxiety issues. Michelle Matush prefers to call it a recovery program, not rehab. Participants commit to 12 months here and also help make a contribution to their costs. It receives no government money and there's a waiting list. Other counselling services in the area have told AM they too have to turn people away.
I've heard some horror stories about people being on waiting lists for 6 months or more. Sometimes it's usually a minimum of 3 months to try and get into anywhere. And unfortunately in this environment, I guess, when people are at that point of wanting to change, it's usually quite desperate situations and they really need to be able to access services quite immediately. Really is life and death oftentimes for people.
She acknowledges different programs work for different people. Hers is a faith-based organisation and she says when success happens, it's delightful.
And just the joy in the parents' eyes when they see their son return to them as the person that they knew them to be before, they face all those challenges has been incredible.
It's now late afternoon and the last passenger train is leaving Albury. I'm standing on the grand old Albury station with a man who's campaigned for reliable, punctual passenger trains for 12 years.
I'm Bill Traill and I'm chairman of the Border Rail Action Group.
That's brag for short. It has members from towns along the North East Rail Line, but most in the twin border town of Albury-Wodonga. The 315-kilometre long rail line, they argue, is not worth bragging about. 4.25 hours to get to Melbourne, if you're lucky.
You've got to be time rich.
Hundreds of millions of state and federal government dollars have been spent on the line for a service he says is slow and not capable of servicing a decentralised population, something that all governments are preaching. If you are a patient who needs or has medical appointments in Melbourne, do you rely on the train service to get you to Melbourne?
Chances are that I won't take the train.
You know of people who don't take the train who are in that situation?
I certainly do. They've lost faith in the railways to deliver in terms of punctuality and reliability.
And that's Bill Traill, the chairman of the Border Rail Action Group. Now, returning to the day's main political story and the Prime Minister's migration plan, our reporter Dan Conifer joins us now from Parliament House. And Dan, how will this plan encourage migrants to live in regional areas is likely to be received by regional communities?
Sabra, good morning. Well, there are a number of communities that the Prime Minister touched on this morning, Warrnambool in southwest Victoria, along with bigger centres such as Adelaide and Newcastle. And in some of those places, there are skill shortages where regional communities have been calling out for people to be directed to their town so that those shortages could be filled, that services could be delivered, and that the economies in those areas could return to normal. And certainly part of the government's plan is to entice university students to regional areas through scholarships and also through allowing students from overseas to work in Australia for longer if they study in a regional area. Now, you'll remember that regional universities were some of the hardest hit by a freeze to funding from the federal government and were looking for international students to help fill their budgetary holes. Today's announcement might just do that.
And what about the business sector? What's been the reaction there?
A different reaction, Sabra. The Chamber of Commerce and Industry, one of the strongest critics of this plan for some time now, a plan that has been floated by the federal government for some months, and again today describing the plan as an economic own goal. The Chamber of Commerce, as well as other business groups, saying that migrants add to the economy, that they actually create jobs and boost employment and boost the skills base of the Australian economy, and to place an artificial artificial limit or change the current regime could be an own goal for what they see as has been a pretty decent system. They say that this is the price that's now being paid for a lack of infrastructure, planning over many years and decades, and that that migrants are paying the price for that.
Reporter Dan Conifer, thank you. Construction of Donald Trump's controversial border wall between the US and Mexico is due to begin next month, and communities in southern Texas along the Rio Grande Valley are bracing for it. The surveyor's pegs have been hammered in, but a fierce local battle is underway between wall enthusiasts and opponents who foreshadowed fresh legal action today. North America correspondent Connor Duffy joined a nighttime border patrol in the Rio Grande Valley.
Hola, ¿cómo estás? ¿Viene solo o qué?
Border Patrol agent Chris Cabrera has been on patrol for only 10 minutes when the first wave of Honduran asylum seekers walked toward him to be arrested.
I mean, this lady's got an infant. You know, anything can happen, not just crossing the river.
The dirt road becomes a highway as wave after wave follow.
¿Viene solo o qué? Okay, ¿cuántos años tienes?
Immigration centres here are overflowing, and tonight in the Rio Grande Valley, more than 1,000 people turn themselves in trying to start a new life in the US. Chris Cabrera and the majority of his workforce have Hispanic backgrounds. They're frequently accused of supporting racism by America's left, but Chris says their only goals are keeping the country safe, as well as looking after those taking this risky journey.
It is very dangerous, not to mention the sicknesses, the illnesses that come with them, whether it be tuberculosis, even something as common as the flu, can really magnify under a journey like this.
Chris Cabrera is a leader with the National Border Patrol Council. He agrees with President Trump that it's a national emergency.
Right now, it's just so out of control on the southern border. It's just a free-for-all. I mean, we don't know what's coming in, who's coming in, when, where. We're overwhelmed.
The wall will be constructed roughly a mile back from the Rio Grande River, leaving some of the region's best farmland in no man's land. A few miles down this snaking brown river border, farmers Kathy and Randy Revis can't wait for the wall to begin.
I know one woman who is now carrying a shotgun in her vehicle. She lives along the river also, so... She's just had it up to here, you know.
Many locals don't agree. Despite conservative stereotypes about Texas, the border city of McAllen, which dominates the Rio Grande Valley, actually votes Democrat. All of the neighbouring counties have a strong Hispanic majority, and construction of the wall will likely see protests. Mariana Wright runs the National Butterfly Centre, where survey pegs for the wall have been hammered in that will leave about 70% of the property stuck between the wall and the river.
They've strung us up and they've just beaten the borderlands with a stick, and of course they have the added benefit of targeting people of colour.
Legal letters have gone out to other river residents, warning them their properties will soon be surveyed too, and they're foreshadowing fresh legal challenges. This is Connor Duffy in the Rio Grande Valley for AM.
The JobActive system aims to help Australians on welfare find a job. In recent years, the network's come under intense criticism from all sides of politics, with many saying it wastes both employers' and job seekers' time. Today, the federal government's announcing what it says is the biggest overhaul of the system in 20 years. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
The JobActive system is heading online. Under changes to be announced by the federal government today, people on welfare will soon be able to use a self-service website to look for work. They'll be able to enter their qualifications and be matched with job vacancies. Employers will also be able to search the online database for suitable candidates. The Jobs Minister, Kelly O'Dwyer, says she's confident job seekers' private data will be secure.
So we're not going to rush to failure. We're going to make sure that we methodically transform the system.
The new system will be trialled in Adelaide South and the New South Wales Mid-North Coast from July and is then set to be launched nationwide in 2022. Ms O'Dwyer says the change will mean significant savings for the government, but she says the actual dollar figure won't be released until the April budget.
those savings that are generated will be reinvested into those people who are long-term unemployed and who face additional challenges.
That could include a greater investment in training and assistance for people who lack important work skills, those who are homeless, or those with drug problems. Peter Strong is the Chief Executive of the Council of Small Businesses of Australia and had been calling for a revamp of JobActive.
It needed overhauling.
He's relieved the government is also moving away from the current requirement for JobActive participants to apply for 20 jobs a month in order to receive welfare payments.
What ends up as a result of that is they visit people that they know they won't get a job with, and the employer knows that that person won't be able to work for them. So it's a waste of everybody's time.
People who don't feel comfortable using the website will still be able to speak to a human being instead. But the new system could mean big changes for the way service providers work, especially if a large chunk of their clients decide they're happy using the self-service site. The head of JobActive provider SYC in South Australia and Victoria, Paul Edgington, says the move to digital was inevitable. He's hoping it won't mean job losses for his staff and will instead allow them to focus on helping more disadvantaged job seekers.
I hope that we are able to bring some of our other expertise in training and education, homelessness services and housing services and wellbeing services to those job seekers, where previously we haven't always been able to do that.
Kelly O'Dwyer has downplayed the likelihood of any job losses. The federal opposition is yet to respond, but both Labor and the Greens have previously called for major changes to the JobActive system.
Alexandra Beach reporting there. Chucking a sickie is a bit of an Australian tradition, but small business owners are complaining that sick days are increasing thanks to the growing popularity of absence from work certificates. They're legal and similar to medical certificates, but they're issued by pharmacists for a small fee. Some businesses say they're now only hiring staff on a casual or commission basis to combat the problem. David Taylor has the story.
Nicole Dwight runs Axis, a Canberra hairdressing business. She's fed up with employees taking what she says are bogus sick days.
In this day and age with social media, I know what, if they're at a music festival or they're at a concert or they're a weekend away, lots of alcohol consumption. I think mostly it's just lack of sleep.
She employs 20 staff, but all of her recent hires are on casual or commission-based contracts. Nicole Dwight says it's her way of dealing with the increasing use of absence from work certificates.
We now have 5 casual employees who do our salon assistant roles because those people, when they don't work, they don't get paid.
The certificates have been available since 2009 under the Fair Work Act. Like a medical certificate, they allow an employee time off work on full pay. But unlike a medical certificate, they can be issued at a pharmacy. The guidelines say the pharmacist needs to judge whether there's enough information to satisfy a reasonable person that the worker is sick. But the Australian Medical Association says it should be a GP and not a pharmacist who makes that call.
A chemist doesn't have the necessary training and expertise to assess what someone's medical problems are.
Pharmacy Guild of Australia National President George Tambasis rejects that.
I can give them a 2-day absence from work certificate and the employer is happy with that, and the law says I'm allowed to do it. The Fair Work Act says I'm allowed to do it as well.
Nicole Dwight says certificate abuse is costing her business tens of thousands of dollars annually. Other business owners say it affects staff morale. Martin Lazar owns Esteem Hair Beauty Spa in Penrith in Sydney's west.
Look, it lets the team down and it can let the clients down because we have people that are booked in wanting, they might want a particular person, that particular person might have that day off.
There's little up-to-date information on how much sick leave costs businesses nationwide. The ABC asked the Minister for Jobs and Industrial Relations for the latest figures, but was told the government doesn't have any stats on absenteeism. For those who are fit for work, Nicole Dwight has this message.
Our parents would have said, no chance, get up, go to work. People are just not so disciplined, maybe. And, you know, and of course, that's a gross generalisation, but if you speak to people across the board in retail service base, a lot of us have the same challenges.
That's business owner Nicole Dwight ending David Taylor's report. And the ACTU Secretary, Sally McManus, has responded to the claims made in this report. In a statement, she says people shouldn't be forced to attend work when they're sick. People in low-paid jobs who aren't getting paid fair pay rises often get a certificate from a pharmacy because going to a doctor is too expensive. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal, where every day we take a deeper look at one big story.
And today's episode is all about how white power groups recruit and what kind of people they target.
Yeah, in fact, we've actually spoken to a guy who used to run a white supremacist group in the US in the 90s.
So what was he thinking and how did he stop? That's The Signal. Subscribe and you'll find us in your podcast feed first thing every weekday morning.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.